This is the Polis Podcast on Colab Radio, and I'm Alexa Mills. Here at MIT's Department of Urban Studies and Planning, there is no formal space to talk about religion or faith, and that doesn't make this place unique. In the United States, the classroom is basically a faith-free zone. It's not like you stop being Catholic, or whatever you are, the moment you walk into class. But you pretty much stop talking about it, even if it seems related to what you're learning. Insofar as secularism helps us coexist, it's a good thing. But is it possible that we're missing something really big in this separation? This podcast allows you to be a fly on the wall as two MIT professors, Phil Thompson and Annette Kim, have a conversation about what it would mean to integrate faith into the study of city planning. Here's Phil.
I went to a community meeting in a place in Haiti that's just mind-blowing. Like 30% of the people have no water or sewage. They drink water out of the sewer. You know, it was just horrendous. And we came into the meeting, and the first thing they did was hold hands, and they knelt down and they said a prayer. And one person said, "There is no light." And I said, because I was raised, you know, in a church, I said, you know, well, as long as there's belief, then there is the light. Because there's something in the Bible that one says, so long as you believe in me, you know, there I am the light. You know, so long as there's belief, there's hope. And as long as there's hope, we can find a way. You know, even where there is no way, we'll find a way. Meaning, you know, if we'll figure it out. And that was just, for me, it was a very moving meeting. But, you know, that, I'm black. And that is what black religion has been about always. That belief. And without that, I mean, nothing mattered. There was no ownership because you were a thing. We were a thing. We were property. There was no ownership. So it had to be something deeper than that, you know, to enable, you know, my ancestors, and that's the tradition I was brought up in. It's like these things are far more important than whatever material anything. Because if we were just concerned about power and acquisition and who owns this and who's going to get that, then we would have defined ourselves as worthless, as non-humans, as nothing. And clearly we knew better than that. So at the very essence of kind of the civil rights movement was that. And so not to teach that means that you're not teaching anything. You don't understand at all what it was people were striving for or what King was even talking about. You know, King said, "I believe in a beloved community." He said, "I'm not here to talk about desegregation. This isn't about us eating at a lunch counter together. It's not about a hamburger and Woolworths. You know, it's not about who sits where in the bus. This is about something far deeper than that." You know, and folks don't even understand it, I think, the way it's being taught, you know, these days. And King said also, it's ridiculous for Exxon to say, we own the oil. Oil is the result of millions of years of development. God put the oil. He said, that's God's oil. It belongs to all of us on earth. You know, it's God's creation. It's not, how can any human being say it's ours? What kind of hypocrisy and idiocy is that? That was his thing. We don't teach that. You know? All of those things we just sort of wipe out because we can't really process that in our instrumental kind of mentality. We just can't process it. So I think it's a disservice not to engage and talk about faith and talk about belief because it's not talking about people.
And what you see is we're so undeveloped in understanding that in academia. Like you're saying, it's so instrumental. It's either, you know, the economic rational paradigm was we're just here to eat and to survive materially. Whereas other critique was it's all about power and domination and that's the only thing you want is more and more power. But there's this whole really important other realm of where do people's aspirations come from? And hope. So I mean, it's this whole realm, and you see it. We come like up against it all the time, but we keep ignoring it because it doesn't fit into our conversation. And I think that's a really important intellectual agenda that we need to correct. As the long history of the Enlightenment you're talking about, that swung it way too far and cut out realms that we could talk about but are there. And it's been a big debate about, is that really there, or is it just figments, you know, people being manipulated, it's in service of the powerful again. But I think it's much more rich and complicated than that. Like Phil is saying, you know, how do oppressed people survive for so long? What drives them forward? What's their hope? And the other thing is planning. I think you're right that we're just another social science that has that secular tradition. But what's interesting about planning students, you know, what kind of people get into planning? I think there's always this root moral reason. You want to make things better. So what is better? What is good? What is right? I mean, there's implicit...
how do we live together?
Yeah, moral persuasion to why we're doing this. It's not just instrumental, and we don't uncover that as well. So it's just such a gaping, obvious lack in what we're doing. And I think it's interesting to me that people want it. I hear that from students. But it's interesting, this climate of silence, of fear, or something that it's not allowed to be talked about. It's not intellectual. It's not valid. So I think we should get it out there.
Well, I think there are a lot of ways. I agree with Annette that this is a big agenda, and it's really important, I think, intellectually, as well as, like, spiritually. You know, to do it. And by, I mean, the spirit of this place, like, to strengthen it. But I think there are a lot of different pathways. And there's a letter that Chief Seattle, was a Native American in Seattle, was named after him, wrote to a U.S. president, I think it was in the 1850s. I mean, to me, it's just, you know, it's so profound. And he was talking about their belief system, like the Native American belief system, and the spirit that resides in all things, you know, like the water, you know, the trees, the animals, like in all things, the stars, in all things. And he was saying, you critique us as savages, but by not really realizing and recognizing the gift, you know, and this that the spirit is in all these things, your society is the one that's not going to survive. You know, you cannot survive, you know, that way. And so I think that is probably one of the most profound environmental statements ever made, which thoroughly integrates spirituality with understanding of the environment and how to live within it. Those things can be lifted up, I think. And in the way in which we study history, these things can be lifted up and recast so we better understand people's motivations through time. And through our engagements with people, we can learn from them and not just come there thinking we have things to teach them. And I think the people are great teachers. Like in Haiti, you know, in New Orleans, it was the same. I think the people are great teachers, and we can draw those lessons out in reflection with people. I think there are a lot of ways... And we need to, you know, in addition to writing books, I mean, that's something I never thought of. But
yeah,
like,
yeah. I think it's first about stories. I think we need stories about this reality that we haven't been acknowledging. So, and I think we're story animals, or, you know, stories connect to us. Mm-hmm. And I think that gets us thinking and learning. So. And that could be either through scholarship or through conversations, or there could be a lot of venues for it. But just getting the stories out, because they're happening. They have happened, but they've just been silenced. So I think we need more stories. And then for our students, I think encouraging their moral development, their wisdom, in addition to their critical thinking and intellect and all that good stuff. So much of making impact is your, I think, you as a person, you know, being able to see that situation in Haiti and what to say. That's wisdom. That's not just strong intellect, right? And that is also very, I think, important. We don't really discuss that.
Maybe we should do a course on it. Seriously.
Yeah, I think there would be actually a lot of interest.
You know, there's something at BU called the Center for Ethical Leadership at the School of Theology. And Martin Luther King's theologian was Thurman, who was a wonderful, wonderful theologian. And King used that to inform his thinking. But the Center for Ethical Leadership has all of Thurman's papers. And what they try and address, they think the reason why social justice movements have fallen down in the U.S. so often is because of this instrumentalism, and they really aren't, they don't have a sense of spiritually, ethically, like there's no spiritual center to inform their ethics and how they deal with each other, and that's why it's so hard. Because you can never really get to deep solidarity or deep unity and purpose just looking out for your own interest, you know? And so they have a whole, you know, center and curriculum and books and stuff like that. Marshall Gans at Harvard has been trying to integrate the Torah into teaching community organizing. And a lot of community groups like IAF and others are religiously based, even though they don't, Gamelion, although they don't talk about it much either. But I think there's a lot of, and there are a lot of theologians now who are writing, I think, very interesting things about contemporary society and how to think about it.
And I think that's so important too, because there's a lot of ignorance, I think, in secular academia about what would religion bring in, the basically politically right only. And there's,
oh yeah,
that's the frustration. And I've heard this, you know, assumed by my colleagues that people who are religious are all extreme right politically. And actually, you know, some of the most important radical solidarity movements have also been faith based as well. And there's many theologies,
yeah.
You know. So I think there's a lot we need to learn in academia about the range of what kind of political action this would lead to.
I also think that I'm going to be real frank. I don't think folks in academia, and I'm mainly talking about the Northeast and the West Coast, have a clue, even in the complexity of thinking of the quote unquote right. And I don't think they engage with it in a serious way at all. And the only white American institution that on its own that has ever apologized for slavery was the American Baptist Association, which is at the core of the evangelicals. And nobody picked up on that. I mean, academia missed that. That is the largest denomination in America. It is the so-called hardcore right. They are the only ones who have apologized for slavery, you know? And I think that's a conversation to be had.
Yeah, and also that, you know, I knew one of the former heads of the Southern Baptist Association who's Korean-American. Mm. I mean, it's not just a white thing. It's actually, there's more people of color around the world that are leading missions. It's transferred. The way they talk about it is it's out of the United States, and it's become a third world movement. You know, so the landscape is really different. I think we're really ignorant about what's going on.
I think bringing faith in will make us more intelligent, not less. I also think that faith is at the core of a lot of things we talk about in a secular way and don't recognize that it's faith-based. Democracy's not proven. It's faith. It's not proven. And if I were to be rational and instrumental about it, I would not be hopeful in this country. I mean, you know, my folks have been enslaved or segregated for almost the entire of American history. So why do I have any faith that, you know, democracy is going to work here with white people? It's not based on rational, it's not reason. And this is something that's been, was discussed a lot in the black community. A lot. Why haven't people just taken to murder, you know, and guerrilla warfare or violence? That's what was part of King's message. He said, well, it has to be based on faith. We have to believe that human beings are not what we've experienced here, that there's something deeper than what we've experienced here. And we have to just believe that and hold on to that faith. Mm. Otherwise, you know, we will just perish. And we will kill, but we'll just perish together. And that was his message. We either come together or we'll perish together. That was the message. People talk about democracy around here. That's what infuriates me, because that's a stupid conversation. To assume that, you know, this thing works and we're just all, you know, fitting in it. Is this smooth sailing? And
we just need participation.
That's a stupid conversation, in my opinion. Nelson Johnson, who's here today, you know, I asked him, like, his church is, like, full of ex-felons. I think collectively they have thousands of years, you know, in his church. And I asked him, like, so what about crime? Like, how do you deal with that, you know, that history and people's tendencies? And he said, if you surround people with love, they will not commit crime. And that's what his church has done. And they've paved a path in that, you know.
That's what I was thinking about when you were talking about King's. I was reading one of his writings about when I think he was in prison, about love, the radical nature of love. That's not rational, but it's the only way out that he could see to really do fundamental change, because that's the only way you could do civil disobedience while you're getting beaten up, right? I mean, it's totally irrational. and so that this concept, you know, of love, the love that Jesus talks about, is really radical. It's high cost. It's high stakes. It's not easy, but it's the only way out, you know. That was so important to me, waking up to social justice, injustice was his.
And I've been so encouraged by, like, we went to the Egyptian student gathering here last year. There were like 500 Arab students mainly here at MIT talking about the movements in Egypt, and they held up their training manual, and it had Martin Luther King on the front cover. And they had studied for 2 years, like, that philosophy and those tactics. It was, like, really powerful, you know, to see them engaging it.